KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW Seattle, this is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. Tuesday, August 6th, is just around the corner, the deadline to return your primary election ballots. Have you voted yet? If not, the Seattle mayoral candidates who have money are making sure their names are in front of you, from yard signs to direct mail to last-minute commercials. You have surely seen them. We're going to talk about that later this hour with our panel of journalists, Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, Knut Berger, the Mossback at Crosscut.com, and C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News. And I know that you three could talk about the mayors for quite some time. But before we get into those weeds, I want to talk about money and jobs and the economy, because we've had a lot of economic news, both locally and nationally. The federal job figures came out today, the GDP yesterday. 160,000 jobs were created last month, which is 20,000 fewer than the analysts expected. We seem to be doing okay in our region, except for the kind of jobs that are coming and the kind of jobs that are going are not equivalent. And I'm talking about Boeing. Boeing announced the departure of yet another slew of jobs. Amazon's hiring, they're not the same. I mean, what does all this strike you three as?
Well, what we have, Seattle is, you know, obviously changing, because there is some sort of sound from Boeing that we are going to gradually, slowly send some jobs to Southern California, South Carolina. You know, they don't come out and say exactly what the five-year out looks like, but that is obviously taking place here, as you know, month after month, drip, 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 however you want to phrase that. And Amazon is hiring quite a bit. This week, as you alluded to, the president went to an Amazon distribution center in Tennessee, where he was talking about how we have to focus in the months ahead on the middle class. And what he is also talking about is, please save my health care plan, because the Republicans have threatened to not fund the government if any money goes to Obamacare. And meanwhile, what you have is everybody getting ready for Obamacare. So we have quite the showdown coming up on that. But the Amazon Boeing thing is an interesting push me pull you that's affecting our very region here in Seattle, just the way the jobs will be here and who will be the dominant corporate presence, since Boeing moved its headquarters to Chicago. It's all so fun to watch.
Yeah, interesting. C.R., you were nodding your head there as Joni was talking about the Amazon Boeing showdown.
Yeah, and I think part of what's going on is the president's getting back to the message he's wanted to be at, which is the economy. It still tops the list of people's priorities. So there's still a concern about the anemic recovery, about the unemployment rate, and he wants to get back into that conversation. I think there's also a legacy thing going on here. I mean, the president has been mired for so many months now in sequestration and, you know, automatic spending cuts and all that kind of stuff. He has yet to be able to really deliver. You know, and then before that, really, his whole first term was about the financial crisis and getting out of that. So he's really been unable to deliver what he campaigned on and what he really has wanted to do, which is really build a strong kind of middle class, you know, help the underclass. I mean, I think he's getting finally, I think in his mind, to the roots of what he came to Washington for. And it's been about the first time he's been able to, because he's been so preoccupied up to now.
It was interesting. The New York Times this morning had an article about the adjournment of Congress for August recess. And the very last thing that happened was essentially Republicans, with a lot of significant infighting, deciding they couldn't think about federal spending, and they let it all dangle till the fall. And what is dangling beyond that, as Joni mentioned, is that there's going to be another showdown about ceiling sequestration, extending the debt limit, and all that fighting on the federal level, it seems, is mirrored in a different way in the state, and how the Republicans and Democrats are are dancing in the state and how Republicans are dancing amongst themselves.
Well, you saw that in the response of some fiscal conservatives to the Boeing announcement about jobs going out. You had Rodney Tom and some of the Republicans basically saying the problem is we're not being enough like South Carolina. In other words, the idea is we need less regulation. We need to stimulate the economy with budget reforms, workers' comp reforms, and things like that. And the argument that Obama and Jay Inslee and others have made is the only way to get out of the doldrums is investment, that you have to invest in education, you have to invest in new economic sectors that can produce the higher wage jobs. So that might be alternative energy or bioscience or whatever. And I think that the problem at the national level is that Congress, even the Republicans, can't agree on the budget. I mean, that was one of the striking things that came out this week, is that you had a division within the Republicans about how much to cut the budget, where to cut the budget, a rift between Republicans in the Northeast and Republicans everywhere else. I think one of the problems with, I mean, it's great that Amazon is hiring. It's great that the jobs are being created. They do pay more than, a lot of people would argue they don't pay enough, but they also pay more than the average.
And more than the fast food workers who are out in the streets.
Nevertheless, those aren't anywhere near equivalent to, Boeing engineers or Microsoft jobs and that kind of thing. And I just think that the divide is over starving the beast, which is the government, or investing, having the government invest to get out of a deep, even if technically the recession is over, it's still a stagnation, slow creep. And, it's going to take more stimulus, I think, and more investment.
Well, one of the things that should be at play or that is at play here is what happened with transportation in our state. So that's an investment that came to a stalemate. And that, I mean, I don't think that's directly connected to Boeing making these decisions about jobs, but transportation, when you invest in transportation infrastructure, it is a signal to businesses that things are moving around here, right?
Well, that was the argument that Governor Inslee was using to try to get the legislature to do something about the budget, correct?
Yes, and it didn't work. I mean, they ultimately didn't go for the gas tax increase of 10 cents, which would have funded, $8 billion worth of projects. I think it's important to keep the Boeing thing in perspective. I mean, there was an announcement of 350, something like that, engineered jobs on aftermarket parts that were going to LA. I mean, this is hardly a mass exodus. If you look at the last 3 years, the net Boeing job increase in the region has been 13,000. So, you never want to see them leave, but the real fight is not over the 300 that just left, but the 777X is a big, huge, new sort of stretch version that the decision has not been made on where that's going to be mm-hmm. built. That's the big fight coming up, and that's what they're trying to land, that here, not in South Carolina.
Will be interesting. Here's one of the things that I watch when you look at Congress and you look at spending and you talk about Rodney Tom. Somebody just emailed in, maybe Rodney Tom should head the state Republican Party, even though he is a Democrat. We watch that infighting that Knut was talking about with some Republicans, more traditional Republicans, saying, look, we need to think about some of these things in a different way, because just, digging our heels into the ground and not giving at all when it comes to the budget has not been particularly productive. When we look at who's going to replace outgoing state Republican Party Chair Kirby Wilbur, some of those issues come up as well, don't they?
They absolutely do. So Kirby Wilbur leaving is a pretty bad day for journalists, because he's so quotable and he's so accessible. He says things he should never say. He knows that. But now it's a sort of interesting thing, because there's so many pieces being written these days about whether the Republicans, whether the Republicans nationally, whether the Republicans in Washington State, you know, as Kirby leaves, there's a lot of talk about, well, how did he do when he was here? Did he
deliver? How did he do?
Well, you know, it depends on how you measure it. So some people want to measure it on the three open Republican congressional seats, which he didn't get, or the governor's house, which he didn't get. The statewide person who was elected, Kim Wyman, Secretary of State, is the only Republican statewide elected official on the West Coast. So, you know, what are you charging Kirby with is the point there. That's the question. So a group of names are emerging as to who might replace them, and they do get to this. What kind of party? So the names that we're hearing are Dino Rossi, Rob McKenna, Susan Hutchinson, Lori Sitella from the King County Republicans has been mentioned, and the name of the
we're going to let CR say it, the person who's the interim Republican Party chair who was Kirby Wilbur's right hand.
Luann Van Werven.
Okay. Thank you, CR. Did you have some thoughts on Kirby Wilbur?
Well, I echo Joni. I loved covering Kirby. He was lots of fun and very quotable. And journalists do kind of regret this week and the news of him leaving. You know, it's a tough job to be the head of a red party in a blue state. You're always fighting a headwind. You kind of relish the small victories because you don't often get big sweeping ones. He really had one election cycle, Kirby Wilbur, that he can kind of be judged on, and that was the 2012, you know, election last fall. And I would say it was a disappointment. And I think he would probably say that, too. I mean, the big kahuna, the thing you want to be judged on, the thing they wanted more than anything and put all their resources into, the governor's race, they didn't get. McKenna was their big, bright hope. And so that's a disappointment for Kirby, for the party, for the McKenna campaign. I mean, it's not just, you know, the state party that's responsible for that. But, you know, it was a tough kind of year for him. I think on the bright side and on the sort of legacy he will leave, the state Senate is the state Senate because of Kirby Wilbur. The majority coalition caucus that kind of took over at the beginning of this year was able to do so because, you know, there were enough Republicans and two renegade Democrats. And that all depended on one race down in Clark County between Don Benton and Tim Probst, which went into kind of overtime.
74 votes was that yeah. race.
And Kirby did something that was brilliant in retrospect, which is after the election was over and the votes were counted, that was race was too close to call. He sent all his army down there, and they went through all the uncounted ballots, most of which had signature problems. They figured out who those people were. They went and knocked on doors. Mm. They got people to sign the affidavits. I mean, he did a field, you know, project down there like no other. They went from being 10 votes behind for Don Benton to winning, you know, a couple weeks later with 78 votes. That allowed Republicans to take control of that Senate. And that has been kind of a lasting legacy for Kirby and the Republican Party.
We're talking about the week's news and beyond. We're prognosticating now with C.R. Douglas, Joni Balter, Knute Berger. I'm Marcy Silman. We're going to continue our conversation in a minute or so here on KUOW.
Asheville, North Carolina was once called a cesspool of sin by a state senator, so we immediately booked our trip. Wait, don't tell me, heads to that isolated colony of locavores, folk revivalists, and artisanal textile artists, along with special guest, Cold Mountain author Charles Frazier. I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for a down-home news quiz. Wait, don't tell me, from NPR.
Tomorrow morning, 10 o'clock on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from AEG Live, presenting the Mary Moore Park Concert Series with Pink Martini, featuring China Forbes, at King County's Mary Moore Park on Sunday, August 4th. Tickets on sale now at axs.com. More information at marymooreconcerts.com.
58 degrees and cloudy in Seattle. Continuing chance of showers through the day with a predicted high of 68. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 1021.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman. And on Fridays in the 10 o'clock hour, we talk over the week's news and beyond with our panel of journalists. And they are Knute Berger, Mossback at Crosscut.com, C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13 Fox News, and Joni Balter, assistant political editor for the Seattle Times. And if you're just joining us, you may have heard the news earlier this week that State Republican Party Chair Kirby Wilbur has decided to take a job in Washington, D.C., effective immediately. And his second-in-command, Luann Van Werven, a former Whatcom County chairperson, is now the interim head of the state party. Hans writes that this is emblematic of the disconnect Republicans have with the modern electorate. She's a far-right Tea Party shill. If the Republicans wish to regain relevance in the state, this is a move in the wrong direction. I hope a moderate Republican is not extinct. Republicans will be if they can't find some modern Dan Evans, is, I guess is how you say it. Bruce Ramsey in the Seattle Times had pretty much the same thing to say.
Yeah, he was talking about how they have to find somebody who can, sort of like what CR said, do the work in a blue state for a Republican Party. And so that is why there's so much soul searching about all this. I noticed that the Everett Herald wrote about saying that it should be Rob McKenna, who clearly seems to want to be active. He has this website, Smarter Government. That's probably not the name of it, but something like that. He has this website, and ever since he lost that big loss, he seems like he wants to have something to say. Being the party chairman is high profile, especially depending on how you play it. There are some party chairs who come in and they don't want a lot of attention. But Kirby was the opposite, shall we say, on that one. He loved attention and he loved stirring things up. But you could see somebody who's well spoken, who's moderate in the way he speaks, to come in and get his name out there quite a bit might be that was what Everett wrote about.
The Republican liberals tend to look at the Republicans in that kind of red blue. It's all one thing or another. But the ecosystem of the Republican Party is complex. They're social conservatives, the kind of Ellen Craswell conservatives. They're the libertarians or pseudo libertarians, which cross between the Tea Party and the social conservatives. So, And the sort of Ron Paul has built up a strong following in the state that's going to be carrying on that kind of libertarian tradition. You have some of the kind of mainstream conservatives, and then you have a few of the people who are considered more moderate. And herding all those cats and having a message that both works statewide but then also works by legislative district and by the realities on the ground in these various areas is very tricky. And previous Republican Party chairs have had it's very taxing. And it takes somebody who isn't in one particular camp. That's one of the things. Jennifer Dunn, I think, did it very well, and she managed to kind of hover at a level where she was able to get social conservatives and others herded to some degree. I mean, even she had problems, but she had the respect of everybody. And that was during the sort of Reagan era. There was a kind of big tent Republicanism that worked. Now it seems to be a lot of separate pup tents.
I like that image.
And of course, one of the problems is the as Joni was pointing out, is the increase of population in Democratic areas and the Democratic vote threaten the Republicans in some of the very major counties.
Well, look what's coming up. So even though Kirby's leaving really quickly, they may not appoint somebody so fast. So 2014 is coming up, and some of these congressional contests will be very competitive again. We do not have a Senate race or a governor's race that year, but we do have congressional seats open.
Carol in West Seattle throws out the name Sam Reed. She says he has enough statewide credibility, and I think people put him in that kind of Dan Evans big tent kind of group of Republicans, don't you think, Sierra?
I think they absolutely do. Listen, it's it's a tougher job than it was when Jennifer Dunn was leading the party, for the reason that the Knut talks about, which is it's a more polarized party. I mean, Kirby did quite a good job of bringing those factions together, because you do have sort of kind of the Ron Paul libertarian segment, you got the Tea Party segment, you got moderates. It's a kind of, you know, it's the same kind of division that is kind of plaguing the Republican Party nationally. You know, the Democrats are pretty unified nationally. They're pretty unified locally. The Republicans aren't. I think a moderate like a Sam Reed, I mean, I don't think he's at all in contention, but someone like that.
Well, who else is like that?
Would have a tough time.
Who else? Who else fits that bill?
Well, I think in some ways Susan Hutchison is that sort of moderate, you know, who would have a problem. It's a pretty conservative state Republican Party board. And I think her problem, though she's expressed interest, now she's not formally been nominated or jumped into the ring, but, you know, when she ran for county executive 4 years ago, it's a nonpartisan race. She kind of ran away from the Republican label. She's not really been involved in kind of grassroots Republicanism. She's tried to kind of stay away from that. So she's going to be viewed with all kinds of skepticism as a true kind of Republican.
But her argument is that she ran for a nonpartisan office, even though we, you know, officially and unofficially kind of double talk there, but that she could rise to this occasion. She's certainly been looking for some office to run for. And so, you know, she's a contender.
I don't know if any of the three of you happen to see an op-ed by a group of moderate Republicans that was published in the New York Times. It was about climate change. William Ruckelshaus, Christy Todd Whitman, a couple other folks had their names on it. And essentially, they were talking to their party members saying, look, we've got to deal with climate change. We have to deal with the environment. You Republican Party as a whole, you are shying away from this kind of issue. So it seems like there are voices emerging saying, you know, we need to consider more.
Well, there was that Pew poll that we all had to prep for today's show, and it talked about, you know, look, after a big defeat, either party is going to have one of these soul-searching sessions. And so the factions that say we should change our position on X, whatever X is, are going to emerge, and they're going to be louder because of the previous defeat. And so in this case, in that Pew poll they were talking about, there is a group of Republicans, a significant percentage, who thinks that the Republicans have to rethink, shall we say, climate change, abortion, and gay marriage. These are some issues, but there's some other issues that...
Immigration was
one of those. So there is that soul searching, and so that's what makes this topic so interesting.
Another name kind of in the moderate camp that's been mentioned is Alex Hayes, who's a Republican organizer mainstream to liberal Republican. So there are people out there who represent that. But whether they could run the state party, I think Alex is pro-choice. I think that would be a problem.
Isn't Sam Reed pro-choice?
Probably. Well, he would be another problem. Not that he's looking for the position, but he really infuriated a lot of conservatives with his role in the contested election with Greg Warren, not liked because of that. And you have to realize that the grassroots of both parties are more liberal and more conservative than the majority of voters, and so. You have to be able to have somebody who can bridge that. Now, McKenna might be able to do that, but I can't imagine that he'd want to take that.
Yeah, I think the best choice would be McKenna. I mean, he obviously lost the race, but you know, it was a real sort of headwind for Republicans last year. But he's been able to kind of bridge that. Mm-hmm. But I think what Knut says is, you know, he's probably. He's unlikely to be interested. Listen, he's off into a new law practice.
I think it's a pay cut, for one thing.
He's very busy.
and he's running the local Boy Scouts.
Yeah, so I'm not sure he wants to back into it.
How do they pick the head of the state Republican
Party? It's a majority vote of the state board, and there's 117 members.
Oh, my gosh.
So, and they, you know, you nominate as many as, I think there's
they
a limited number
ballots.
Of nominations. So you go through ballots
they
and you drop the lowest one off. And so, you know, you can.
It's like Survivor.
It's like the old Politburo or something.
Somebody emailed to ask if we're going to talk about the mayor's race. Yes, we are. But there are other things. We'll definitely get to that. I just wanted, before we left this idea of Republicans and conservatives, I just need to talk about Pope Francis a second, because he really shook up people. I believe it was Monday, very early Monday morning. He'd gone to Rio, Brazil with his entourage of reporters. He told them setting out he wasn't going to give any interviews. On the way home, the Pope sauntered back, I guess, to where the reporters
were.
To the coach class.
Holy smokes.
Stood up and talked about anything that they wanted to talk about. And one of the things that made headlines initially, there were two. He talked about a lot of stuff, but he talked about gay priests in particular. And he's like, what he said was, who am I to judge them if they've got the Lord in their hearts? And
it was the who am I judge heard round the world, wouldn't you say?
Because
it was a different way for the Pope, a Pope to speak. He's a very gentle presence, and he's very sort of understanding of sort of all kinds of people, and he proves that day after day with the various things he does. But the reason why it reverberated so loudly around the world was that was quite an unusual comment for a pope to say, because usually what popes say is something about, you know, that's very, you know, unkind and unrespectful of gay folks. So.
We talked to a couple of theologians the next day, and a very liberal woman who aspires to priesthood said, well, you know, this is just stylistic, that he's got the same beliefs as Benedict and the conservatives. We talked to a professor of theology from Santa Clara University down in California who said, no, I think that instead of you know, writing some manifesto, he's leading by example, and that this did indicate at least some change of attitude. I just thought it was interesting, because you don't often hear popes talking about gay priests this way, or women for that matter.
I just love the who am I to judge. Well, you are the Pope. Hello. That's kind of your role. So I think it's huge. I think it's, you know, it doesn't change the substance of Catholic doctrine, but it changes the tone. And I think that's enormous. I mean, it's hard to see that, you know, with the tide of history going the way it's going, that you know, the sort of Catholic Church's attitude toward gays is going to be able to continue, you know, forever. I mean, at some point, love the sinner but hate the sin is a kind of construct that I believe is going to probably fall apart. And, you know, if you're not going to judge the sort of person, then at some point you're not going to judge the act. So it's not going to change overnight. It's going to be incremental, and this is probably one piece of that incrementalism.
If he's signaling that the church is going to be less persecutorial toward gays and lesbians, that's great.
Unless one last thing about people being judged. Here's somebody that a lot of people in Seattle love to judge. Alex Rodriguez is being threatened with his lifetime ban. And I read an article saying that he was being bullied by baseball, that baseball was too hard judging A-Rod. And Knut looks at me like, are you out of your mind? I didn't write the article. No. I read the article.
You read the
reading is sometimes, you know, troublesome in that way.
Well, I mean, you know, A-Rod, for those of us who remember him from Seattle, I mean, this has just been a tremendous fall.
Yes.
You know,
absolutely.
This was a golden boy. We loved him. The first time the fans turned against him, of course, was when he went to the Rangers and took a huge contract.
You mean Payrod?
Payrod, yeah. And it's just been downhill from there. I mean, Madonna and
Cameron Diaz.
Illegal, you know, allegations of illegal use of substances that are banned by baseball, and He's disliked in New York. The Yankees apparently, I think they're rooting for a lifetime ban so they can
because
make
because they owe him so much.
They owe
money.
Him so much money.
They owe him
it just turned a whole payroll.
This,
but I think the lifetime ban thing, of course, I think is being brought up as leverage to get him to accept some kind of a thing. But they want to suspend him,
right?
And so it's kind of like you threaten with a death penalty and then we give him something else. But the thing that seems to be involved from the reports that are coming out is that not only was he using these illegal substances after he said he wasn't, but that he tried to destroy evidence that he was. In other words, that he actively sought to. So it's it seems to be a classic example of a cover up that's worse than the crime.
Yeah, that's usually.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens. But it's a tragic story from the standpoint of Seattle sports fans. What could have been versus what is.
Producer Jason Pagano says that they're still on some Seattle Times boxes. You know where you put the coin in and our paper thing comes out. There's an ad of. Featuring A-Rod reading the Seattle Times.
Well,
I'm not sure if you want that.
Sam been out there changing the cards in the boxes.
He has good taste in newspapers, but, you know, I get what you're all saying. You know, my daughter was in the early days of A-Rod. Her room had all these pictures of A-Rod, and so it's a spectacular fall here.
We are talking over the week's news, and if you've been just chomping and yelling at your radio because we haven't talked about the Seattle mayor's race, stay with us. Joni Balter, C.R. Douglas, Knute Berger, and me, Marcy Silman, will talk about that next on Weekday.
Hello again, I'm Aaron Olney. On the next To The Point, in the new sharing economy, you can rent out your car or a seat on your couch, even turn your home into a restaurant. More than 200 tech companies are competing to facilitate informal exchanges. Are new regulations required, or is trust enough? Is the traditional way of doing business in for a change? Next time on To The Point from Public Radio International.
Oh, that's just 30 minutes from now on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from King County and Snohomish County elections, reminding voters that the final day to return a ballot is Tuesday, August 6th. Ballots must be returned to a ballot drop box or postmarked no later than Election Day. For more information, check the local voter's pamphlet or contact elections officials.
Well, it's cloudy this morning in Seattle, 58 degrees. Forecast says the clouds are going to stick around, possibly bringing us some showers through the day, with an afternoon high of 68.
This is Weekday. I'm Marcy Silman, and Tuesday is August 6th, and that is the day that you have to have your primary election ballots returned in the mail. I think they have to be postmarked by midnight that night. And Knute Berger, Joni Balter, and C.R. Douglas were just having a heated one-minute conversation about who has and who has
not voted.
It was
only a minute.
It was only a minute, but it was incredibly heated. I have not yet returned my ballot, I confess.
Well, did you see that the turnout so far, the percentage of ballots returned is only at 12%? So apparently one thing people are going to do this week, in addition to the whole hydro thing,
is vote,
is maybe vote and just make a decision about this race.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not, yeah. Because there are at this point, and we've said this week after week, at least four candidates. Any two of whom could win.
Well, this is, as I mentioned long ago, just after 10 o'clock when I introduced you, this is the weekend where anybody who has any money left in their campaign fund is deluging your mailbox, my mailbox, putting up their signs. And it was interesting, the incumbent mayor, Mike McGinn, put out a very interesting ad that got some interesting feedback. We're going to hear a little clip of that ad.
Hi, I'm Mike McGinn. And some people say this mayor's race is about style. And I have to admit, when I came into office 4 years ago, I wanted to change everything all at once. And I've had to learn how to be mayor. I don't think this race is about style. I think it's about substance. And I don't really think it's about us candidates. It's about what you, the voters, care about.
I don't know where this ad actually ran. I saw it online. It got tossed around a lot of places. This ad is a close-up of the mayor, shoulders up, looking into the camera. After this is the beginning of the ad that you just heard, which is a sort of left-handed apologia, mea culpa for my style. It's not really about that, but it's interesting. So this got jumped on by Election Nerd at Publicola, who I can't even remember how what the headline was, but it was essentially, you know, his last-minute desperate attempt to cling to one of the two top spots in the primary.
I don't know about desperate. What it sounds like to me is, and I've heard him say this at the forums, is that he had to learn how to be mayor. That's a phrase he's been using. And he's referring to his rough start. He knows that the public thinks he had a rough start. That's why he's sitting on 22%. What does 22% mean? It means that something like 3 out of 4 voters are not in the mood. You know what I mean? So he is making a direct appeal to say, I had to learn how to be mayor. I wanted to do it all at once. So there was not quite mayor school, but if there was, I'd go.
Okay.
I was noted in that. I mean, you never want to have a campaign video that starts with an apology and where you are acknowledging the criticisms of you. Okay, I think generally that campaign wisdom would say you don't do that unless you absolutely have to.
So did they absolutely have to? Why?
Well, I think probably they did. I mean, I think they probably are seeing that he has a steep hill to climb with the voters. The polls have consistently showed that his polling is less than Greg Nichols was when Greg Nichols lost in the primary. So, you know, that is a concern. He also is using his kind of the voice he probably uses to talk to kittens in that particular ad.
The voice was very soft.
Mike McGinn. But he's always been good at that kind of speaking to the camera. That was how he launched his campaign initially. He's good at doing that kind of thing. But in general, I think to me, what's really striking about the race is how many undecideds there still are. Joni was talking about how few ballots have gone in. I think people are waiting to make up their mind. I was at a crosscut function last night talking to people. These are very civically engaged people. I was amazed at how many people were still undecided. It wasn't just that they hadn't mailed their ballot. They hadn't made up their mind. And so I think with McGinn's videos, with every day in the mail, I get a different Ed Murray piece. I think that there's a real clamor for the number of people who support undecided, which has consistently been 20. Higher than who support individual candidates.
CR?
Well, I think, and by the way, it is a TV ad. I think it was a $60,000 cable TV ad buy.
Really?
So it'll get heavy rotation. And I think, you know, it's different than any of the other ads he's had so far, which are testimonials from supporters. This is the first ad McGinn's been in. I think it is an attempt to sort of close the deal by sort of speaking directly to the voters with you know, a slight mea culpa, but also just a tone, as you were saying, that makes him look, you know, pretty harmless, you know, getting criticized as divisive. Who, this guy? You know, he's trying to sort of shatter, if he can, at this last, you know, hour, this sense that he's, you know, divisive and kind of can't bring people together and sort of speak Seattle. And I think he does that pretty well in this ad. Whether that comes too late, who knows? I mean, there are people that are still undecided. But what we're realizing also is that as undecideds kind of make up their mind, it does look like, you know, Ed Murray is the guy that's getting sort of, you know, we all wonder, where are these undecideds going to go? Who are they going to land with? Well, it looks like kind of the polling you hear about is that he's kind of solidifying his lead, and that we are talking about maybe who's going to get into second.
Well, so the mailers that I'm getting from Ed Murray I'm not quite sure what the message is. I'm voting for Ed. That's the message.
Yeah. Well, there was a mailer earlier this week that had a big endorsement from Charlie Royer. Mm-hmm. So That was one. One that came in the mail yesterday had a family. I voted for, you know, yes. I've decided. And I think that is who they're going after. It's showing somebody that, that these are typical Seattleites. They're just like you. And they've decided to vote for Ed. So it's clearly pitched at undecided. The one thing I do want to mention about who might get through is the poll, not the poll, but the kind of survey that Seattle Weekly did up in the North End. They found a precinct that has voted right since the Paul Schell years in every election, and not just voted right, but has the exact percentage that that has come down. They got Malahan and McGinn right to the decimal point,
mm-hmm.
and they went up there and doorbelled. And of course, what they found was undecided was got the most votes, but the tie was between McGinn and Steinbrück, and. I think that's really interesting. If it turns out that's a bellwether precinct, that's one of the kind of indicators that some of those undecideds, it's not necessarily going to go Murray's way.
The reason that's interesting is because polling in these mayoral races is notoriously bad. It was completely off 4 years ago. You know, we can read the polls and we think we know what's going on, and yet I don't. Think those polls have proven to be that good. The Ed Murray message, I have been trying to figure that out too. It seems to be certain, and that's what McGinn was addressing in that spot there. It's certainly about style. I know how to get along with people better than you do. There's another thing he seems to be saying, but it's not actually said in these words, that he's the safe choice, that you know him.
Mm-hmm.
You've known me all these 18 years that I've been in the legislature. And he also touts the fact that he doesn't sort of push for policy immediately. He's an incrementalist. That's how he did gay marriage. That's how he did gas taxes. That's how he does things. He approaches things with, you know, so what if I lose 1 year, I'll come back the next year. And sort of like, you know, I'm not so in your face. That seems to be what I'm reading.
I think if we are talking about kind of who might squeak through as the second choice, whether it's kind of come down to McGinn versus Steinbrück for that slot, I think you will have sort of ground game versus last name, if you will. I mean, the mayor has a very good field operation. He knows how to do this. He got his start organizing with the Sierra Club. It's kind of in his DNA. Mm-hmm. They're doing all kinds of phone banking. They're getting out the vote, all that kind of stuff. That is just a sophisticated machine. Peter doesn't have that. Got off to a late start with Field, but he's got this last name. He's got this like legacy in this city that you cannot buy. And it's especially valuable with older voters who remember the fight of the Pike Place Market in the 70s with his father, and they disproportionately vote in these off-year primaries.
Well, and I would just add to that, a lot of that last name familiarity is Peter's own name,
yeah.
Which is that he was a very popular city council person for a lot of years. So he has won citywide before. And I think it's both Steinbrück's.
Well, what about both Murrays? And what I mean by that is that
Patty?
There's Senator Murray and then there's Senator Murray. And I just have always wondered, I have no idea if this is true, if when somebody hears a news story and they say Senator Murray without the first name, if he sort of gets across. I have no idea on that one. But speaking to the ground game in general, first of all, the McGinn ground game in 2009 is what won it for him. He had a very, I think it was phone banking, I think it was doorbell, I think it was the whole darn thing. And what we saw with that sophisticated ground game also came up in last year's governor's race. The Inslee camp used some very sophisticated, you know, they knew where the voters were sort of more than the McKenna camp. And I remember after the governor's race, Rob McKenna was talking about how that was something to definitely learn about and copy.
We have a couple of comments about mayors. First, from former King County Council member Brian Jurdowski, who says, Joni, the Times did one of the worst hatchet jobs on Peter Steinbrück I've ever seen. The second is from Evan and Ballard, who says, as a long-term Seattleite with a six-month-old son, I've been watching this mayor's race closely. After seeing and meeting a few of the candidates, I'm surprised at the lack of political polish some of these folks have. How do Seattle mayoral candidates compare to those in other cities. In a city with a high degree of citizen engagement and a lot of master's degrees, is there a lack of interest in politics? Where is the charisma?
The only other mayor's race that's really getting my attention
in New York
is that one back there in New York City.
Do we want that?
And I'm just saying, which one's more sophisticated?
Yeah. I don't think anybody wants that choice.
I've written about this before. I mean, being mayor of Seattle, for the person who's in that office, it's probably a life-changing and highlight of their career. It certainly is not a jumping place to anywhere else, nor is it – I mean, it's a pretty unglamorous job in a lot of ways. You know, Seattle, I think, has a kind of Seattle culture, I think, does have a kind of suspicion of politics and politicians, and we are very fickle, and we, you know, are willing to remove people or throw out incumbents. We seem to always be somewhat dissatisfied with who's ever in there. And I think this crop of candidates is actually stronger than we've had in the recent past in terms of the experience they bring. I think it's a really great field, and maybe that's one reason people are having trouble making up their mind. Maybe it's not. But.
Well, if you look at it generically, you have an incumbent mayor, you have a state senator, a current council member, and a former council member. Those are not just people that's, you know, were sitting, as they say, sitting on the couch and decided to jump in. These are people that have been
in politics. We have one of those, too.
And we have one of those, too. But these are people who have been in politics, who know something about the city, somewhere between something and quite a lot.
I mean, part of what's going on and why it's not ignited huge, you know, citywide debate is because it's not been a race about big things. The leading contender here, Ed Murray, made a decision very early on to have a safe campaign. And the bet was that all you had to do is be a reasonable alternative to McGinn, that there was enough displeasure, unhappiness, and dislike with the incumbent that you just show up and you talk about your background and your credentials, and that was going to be enough. It didn't need to be about big ideas. The safer, the better. And that has been the campaign he's run. He's had a couple of lucky sort of points along the way when Burgess dropped out.
Yes.
But largely, this has been the Ed strategy from the beginning, and it's working.
What are the issues that they should be addressing?
Well,
or do you think that's going to happen August 7th?
That too, but you know, the one thing I want to say about these candidates is they have been out campaigning. They have been to so many forums.
Yes, they have.
They have answered questions that, you know, I don't know if I've seen those every year, but they have answered because it's such a competitive race with strong candidates. They have answered questions on all the topics that you can imagine, the whole police business, the whole transportation business, leadership questions. I mean, they're not really missing big questions. I mean, the other thing to consider here is Seattle's starting to boom again. And so there will be a little bit of a run on fumes, the good fumes of what's going on with the economy.
Well, I tried to sort that out in a story that I did earlier this week about the visions of the candidate.
Yes.
Like, what is the – Seattle likes the big dream, the big vision, the city on the hill type of deal. So what is that for each of the candidates? And you can argue about whether those – I mean, Murray is focused on leadership. His vision is small ball. It's I'm an incrementalist. I'm experienced. I'm reasonable. I'm not flashy. And that appeals to a certain part of Seattle, certainly, and he has a record there. You know, Bruce Harrell speaks to one Seattle. And as a minority candidate, as somebody who has – as a corporate attorney, a city council member, but as somebody who grew up in South Seattle, you know, he positions himself as the person that can unite Seattle in terms of social justice. And he sees it as kind of a marriage between – sort of social justice and corporate support.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he thinks the corporate community could do more for schools and that kind of thing. So he's sort of the one Seattle guy. Peter Steinbrück has emphasized neighborhood. And what he's talking about is a city that isn't, that doesn't become a kind of prisoner of corporate development. We stay true to the fact that we're this complex, diverse city of kind of cultural islands and neighborhoods, and that he's the best person to do that. And Mayor McGinn is very clear. He says he wants Seattle to be the most progressive city in America, and he wants to be the mayor of it.
We get this email from Mandy. I have never been so, and that's in caps, been so excited about a mayoral race ever before. And then she goes on to say, Peter Steinbrück is going to defy conventional wisdom that says Ed Murray is going to win a top spot. Frankly, I don't see the attraction of Murray. He touts 20 years in a mostly do-nothing legislature. That's good. Peter's record shows a commitment to Seattle and vision. I think he will do really well. And maybe that's those votes that you're talking about in the bellwether precinct that you were citing.
Well, I don't think it's very, you know, Peter, I mean, I think has a very strong passion for the city. And I think that comes through. And I think it comes through with Harold as well. I think both of them are born and raised in Seattle, mm-hmm. and they have very passionate presentations on that topic. To a degree, the passion that you've seen sort of in the race and that you will see if they make it into the final is the tension between Ed Murray and Mike McGinn, who clearly don't seem to like each other. And I think if those two get through, you're going to see a very bare knuckle campaign.
I think Peter Steinbrück would have won had he jumped into the race in 2009. Mm-hmm. So this is clearly a strong candidate. I agree. It's his work as a council member and his father's work, which is the legacy of that name. Peter is the one person that's trying to make it a race about ideas. I mean, he is actually the one out there taking McGinn on sort of substantively, whether it be the arena, whether it be with growth, that kind of stuff. So give him credit for that. He's there trying to bring these up. I think once two of these get through the primary, you're going to have a more substantive campaign. It's hard when you have a field of nine.
And Bill says, I'm still undecided. I'm waiting to see a big vision or reason to vote for Murray. Well, you guys don't have a lot of time because you got to have those things in the mail on Tuesday, August 6th.
Going by the stamps, you know.
Yep. And next Friday, we'll be talking about the two, and then we have more months. We just want to end with this comment from Jim, who says, the image on the Seattle Times boxes is not A-Rod. It was never A-Rod. Our producer, Jason Pagano, is pointing at himself, mea culpa, mea culpa, mea culpa. Jim thought we would know better, and clearly we haven't looked at those boxes in a while, so we're going to do some first. Jason's going right out to check the boxes. And
I don't see a notepad in his hands.
We take recorders, Joni. Joni Balter is assistant political editor for the Seattle Times, C.R. Douglas political analyst for Q13 Fox News, and Knute Berger, the Mossback at crosscut.com. Thanks all of you for coming in and talking with me today. Our show is produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Alsadi, and Andy Hurst. Bernard Ouellette is the engineer. Danielle Anthony Goodwin, an intern. I'm Marcy Silman. Join us again on Monday.
$10.59. You want to get more done, you got to work more, right? Yeah, well, maybe not. Listen to this. French workers are more productive than American workers, even though they work less. That's what a recent study shows us. But how can that be true? KOW's Ross Reynolds is going to look into it today at noon. And we're thinking maybe you can help us figure this out. If you've figured out a way to work less but do more, we want you to call right now, 206-221-3663. Tell us your strategy for working less but getting more done. 206-221-3663, and we're going to get into that today during the noon hour. KUOW FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Bumbershoot, 3 days of art, comedy, and music at Seattle Center this Labor Day weekend. This year's lineup includes local artists Heart, Death Cab for Cutie playing Transatlanticism, and more. Tickets and information at bumbershoot.org.
Your primary ballot needs to be returned by August 6th, and the Seattle mayoral race has 9 candidates. Plus, there are contests for Seattle City Council, Seattle School Board, and a parks levy. If you're not sure how to fill out your ballot, KUOW has been covering the campaigns since last year. Go to KUOW.org and click on the election button for our handy voter's guide. And don't forget to vote.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.